The main issue that I believe with regard to the assignment of error, as the court can see, the assignment of error was that the trial court erred by refusing to grant the motion to strike both at the end of the Commonwealth's case as well as at the end of the case in general. The crux of the argument is whether or not there was a confidential relationship between Ms. Pittman and Ms. Pettis. So in order to be found guilty of embezzlement, the accused has to be entrusted with the property of another. Entrustment, in order to entrust property of another, someone needs to give responsibility for something after establishing a confidential relationship. And then we get to what is a confidential relationship. I think both counsel have relied on the case of Gelber versus Glock, a 2017 Supreme Court case. One person stands in relation of special confidence towards another so as to acquire, and I'm putting emphasis on this, habitual influence over him. A confidential relationship arises when it's clear that the parties don't deal on equal terms, but on one side there's an overmastering influence or on the other weakness, dependence, or trust. A confidential relationship will arise when a party is bound to act for the benefit of another and can take no advantage to himself. And Mr. Anderson on the Commonwealth's reply brief did indicate, and I would agree with him, that there's no reason not to believe that this definition of a confidential relationship wouldn't apply in this case. That's a civil case. It's an estate issue. But I believe that we can still use that definition from Gelber versus Glock. And I also believe that case did reference, did quote another case that I had used in my brief, Hancock versus Anderson. It's a 19.
But, counsel, let me interrupt you and ask you this hypothetical. Suppose I want to dine at a fine restaurant, has valet parking, and if I'm going to dine there, I'm going to have to give my car keys to the valet, and he decides to take my car and drive off somewhere with it and wreck it. You know, I don't get my car back. Mm-hmm. Is that enough to establish an entrustment situation?
Well, I would say in that situation, we'd have to look at whether or not there's influence over you. Are you in a position of weakness compared to where he is? And in some senses, you want to dine at this restaurant. In order to dine there, you need to park your car. In order to park your car, you've got to...
I guess what I'm getting at is you don't need to have, you know, it doesn't have to be your best friend in the world in order to establish the kind of relationship. Although here, apparently, we do have close, you know, personal friends involved.
Well, I think in this relationship, though, the evidence showed that Ms. Pettis indicated that they hadn't been in contact for a while. She did not...
She comes and picks her up.
I mean, yeah.
You know, from the hospital.
She did. But she also, when on cross-examination, when she was asked, isn't it true that the relationship was estranged, she didn't deny that. She said that the relationship was estranged. And when she had been posed with the statement, well, you all had been friends, Ms. Pettis responded, no, we hadn't seen each other. There had been a gap. You know, we hadn't communicated in a while.
But friends can, you know, and family, too, sometimes can be almost estranged. But if someone is ill and calls them and said, I need you, can you come pick me up from the hospital or take me to the hospital or whatever? And then here, after that, she wants the car to go pick up her medication from CVS, I guess it is. Why isn't that essentially... They've been good enough friends that she drops everything she's doing and picks her up from a hospital and then loans her a car so she can get her medication.
I think that the evidence showed that they weren't as good of friends as Your Honor is characterizing them. I understand she did. She went to go pick her up from the hospital. But when in her direct testimony as well as cross-examination, Ms. Pettis really downplays the nature of their relationship. Also, with regard to the definition of a confidential relationship, there isn't any evidence. There wasn't any evidence with regard to what their relationship was before this particular day.
Well, it seems to me we're overthinking this because, you know, while we can get down in the weeds and talk about, you know, legal terms of art and all, isn't what it boils down to is with the word entrustment that you. The word trust is in there. You trust the individual with your property, valuable property, enough that you think they're going to keep it safe for you or use it for the express purpose you've allowed them to use it for in this case. So it becomes a totality of the circumstances analysis where you're looking at, gee, you know, if it's a, you know, $10 item, that's one thing. If it's a $6,000 automobile, that's something else. If, you know, diamond ring, it's something, you know, you have to kind of look at all the facts and circumstances and give some deference to a fact finder that looks at those and determines, yes, this is enough to constitute an entrustment. You know, there is a close enough relationship. You know, you never did answer my question about the valet, I guess, so... you know, would that be a situation?
I would say that was more of an entrustment situation than between Ms. Pettis and
Ms. So you think that's a more clear-cut situation than what we have here?
Well, because in that situation, you are in a position of weakness in the sense that you're in order to do what you need to do, you need to in order to dine at this fine restaurant, you have to hand over your car in order to park to get, you know. In this situation, Ms. Pettis didn't. There wasn't any moment of weakness in terms of someone just. I mean, Ms. Pittman just said, "Can I borrow the car?" Sure, that was it. There wasn't a. There wasn't anything specific about that relationship.
Well, she had a migraine, and she's like, "So you might be considered weak if you're not able to drive." And the woman says, she
"Or she's being deprived of her only means of transportation at that point." I mean, it's some. That's, you know, you have to look at the circumstances. As I said so. You know, the car was given to your client with the expectation it would be a short errand and the car would be promptly returned. When it wasn't, that, of course, posed up, it seems to me, a pretty severe hardship for this particular individual. I won't refer to it as the victim because arguably Enterprise is probably the victim here as well. So, but nonetheless, it certainly imposed a hardship on her, and, you know, that it made her dependent on this individual returning the car so she could resume her normal activities.
Well, the rental car agreement was between. So I guess when you're saying it in terms of the
we're not talking about a contract situation,
right? But in terms of the relying on the transportation, the facts indicated that Ms. Pettis had had rented the car for the sole purpose of getting Ms. Pittman from the hospital, not because that was her mode of transportation on a daily basis. She didn't have a mode of transportation.
Of course, and nothing else, the hardship was she's now paying for a rental car that's not,
correct.
She can't
that
return.
That might be the hardship. I don't know what the hardship is, that she no longer has daily transportation or whatnot. But I think what Your Honor is trying to kind of look at is like the position of weakness, right, that Ms. Pettis is in the position of weakness by loaning the car to Ms. Pittman. But again, as Judge Beals, you indicate that Ms. Pettis had this migraine and that she was in that moment of weakness. But that's not a defining characteristic of their relationship to put her in the moment of, in a position of weakness. I think when the case law talks about this moment of weakness, we talk about this fiduciary relationship where we have an agent, a trustee, and whatnot. Not so much because you're ill and that's the moment of weakness. I don't think that the case law was talking about physical incapacity.
Well, in Chang, this court's decision in Chang in 1988, didn't it say that, you know, no formal fiduciary relationship is necessary for conviction for embezzlement in a situation?
It did. My understanding, though, Your Honor, is that it says the existence of a formal fiduciary relationship is not necessary, but that you must prove that the defendant was entrusted with the property of another. But then we go on to the next question is, what does entrustment mean? So that formal relationship, that's true. It doesn't have to be employer-employee, and I think that's why this case even was indicted the way that it was, is because there doesn't have to be employer-employee. But again, if we're looking at what does entrustment mean, in order to entrust, you have to give something, give someone the responsibility for something after establishing the confidential relationship. And that's where we then get to the definition in Gelber versus Glock. What does a confidential relationship entail? And so the argument is that Ms. Pettis and Ms. Pittman did not have this confidential relationship.
Well, common law embezzlement, of course, larceny implies that you're taking property without consent of the owner. Embezzlement is a flavor of larceny where you're actually acquiring the property, you know, with the consent of the person. Typically, if you're embezzling from the cash register at a convenience store, those customers are giving you the money voluntarily. They're expecting it, you know, you're simply, instead of turning it over to your employer as you should, you're converting it to your own use.
Right.
Isn't that exactly what happened here?
Well, but Ms. Pettis wasn't giving Ms. Pittman the car in order to turn it back over to Enterprise. I mean, Ms. Pettis was violating the contract that she had with Enterprise with regard to the use of the vehicle. That was an exhibit that that the Commonwealth had presented, that she actually didn't have the authority to provide the car to Ms. Pittman, because her contract with Enterprise said, you're not allowed to let anybody else drive this car.
Are you suggesting if I ask Judge Attlee if I can borrow his car to run an errand and he never sees me again, that's not a crime?
I'm not saying it's not a crime. I'm saying it's not embezzlement.
Okay.
That would be unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, which is maybe what this should have been indicted under.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, and that was something that I think I wasn't trial counsel, but when I'm looking at this, it says, why wasn't this unauthorized?
We don't have prosecutors that actually bother to look at the Code of Virginia anymore to determine what the right charge is.
That would have been the cleaner case than this, because it was unauthorized use. Even if Ms. Pettis didn't have the authority to give it to Ms. Pittman, Ms. Pettis said, this is the permission that I'm giving you for this vehicle. You can use it to go to CVS. Once she exceeded that permission, that's unauthorized use of the motor vehicle, because she was beyond the consent. With regard to embezzlement, I think I'm past my time, but with regard to the embezzlement, I don't believe that, again, we're then talking about a confidential relationship with unauthorized use. You don't need to.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Reserve the rest of your vote. Good morning, Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. Please, the court.
You want to start where we just left off with why shouldn't this have been an unauthorized use instead of an embezzlement? We're having this discussion right now.
I probably could have charged that, but of course it's well settled that prosecution has discretion if...
provided the charge is supportable in the law.
Right. So I rise and fall with whether or not the embezzlement conviction can stand. But if it can, then that's the answer to that question.
So how confidential does it have to be a confidential relationship?
I think some of these terms, Your Honor, are words of art. I really wonder if entrustment is one of them. I think I win under any technical definition of entrustment, but under any sort of normal lay sense of entrustment, I went under that as well. But the confidential relationship, we go to Gelber versus Glock, which is quoted in my brief, and it's been alluded to, and I think it quoted an old case, Hancock. And the members of the court, I think, have focused on the same thing that the trial judge did in convicting the defendant, which is to talk about this notion of weakness, dependence, or trust. If you have that, then you have the confidential relationship.
Well, let me stop you there, Mr. Anderson. Now, the word or is in there, so that's a disjunctive. So it seems to me Glock stands for the proposition that in order to have a confidential relationship, there has to be either one, an overmastering influence, or two, a weakness, dependence, or trust. And I guess the words justifiably repose modify the words trust, or do they modify the entire preceding clause?
Well, I think, first of all, just a matter of English and logic, if you have overmastering influence, one of the byproducts of that would be weakness on the other side. So I think they're all linked.
But I mean, if all you had is trust, in other words, I trust Judge Beals enough to give him my car. Is that enough? Because if I justify, and I guess if he steals my car, maybe my trust wasn't justifiably reposed in retrospect, but, I mean, isn't that measured at the time?
Well, it also, Your Honor, early on in the quoted language talks about where one person stands in relation of special confidence towards another. In that hypothetical, I'm sure as fraternal as you all are, I'm not sure that fits within the language of special confidence. In this particular case, the actions of the, I don't want to say victim, although in a sense that's true, Ms. Pettis, certainly indicated this relation of special confidence. I mean, the defendant calls her up apparently in some abrupt fashion and says, my girlfriend has done whatever she's done. Can you come to the hospital? She lives in Albemarle County. Can you come to the hospital in Harrisonburg and pick me up? And she originally tried to make some other arrangement, but apparently this other person didn't like Ms. Pittman. So then she goes to Plan B, and she doesn't have her own car. She goes to rent a car. She goes all the way to Harrisonburg to pick her up, which is pretty, I think, striking actions indicating this special competence. By the time she gets there, she's having severe migraines. And because she doesn't really know the area and can't follow the driving instructions of Pittman, the end result is Pittman takes over and they make their way back to Albemarle. And she even offers to get her a hotel room for the night, and she declines, which is a parenthetical, makes you wonder what she had in mind, since that would have been an easy way to deal with it. She turns, the point being that Ms. Pettis does all of these things so far above and beyond the norm, and then she permits the defendant, supposedly, just to drive 2 miles to CVS to get a prescription, and then she'd be back. And rather than that happening, the car was found at a body shop in the state of New York 9 days later with about $6,500 worth of damage. By any measure, the Pettis was operating from a position of weakness, and in the context of the situation, the defendant who had the car had this overmastering influence, and therefore an unfair advantage is possible. The trial judge in denying the motion to strike, and I think also in rendering his verdict, referred to the bad position that Ms. Pettis had been put in, and it got worse by the day, financially and legally. Now, counsel today, and I'm not sure she did this on brief, but she is suggesting in response to several questions from the court that, well, if you look at the Pettis' testimony on cross and you know, the suggestion is, well, they weren't really that friendly, and she used the words estranged, and I think, frankly, she probably misused the word. But beyond what I think, if you go to page 80 of the appendix, the trial judge in his verdict says, while Ms. Pettis used the phrase estranged friends, I find it's meant to show they had not had contact in a while, as opposed to meaning that there was a strain in the relationship. I think the estranged was talking about the level of contact, not the nature of the relationship. That is, by any measure, a finding of fact, and like any other finding of fact, it's enforceable on appeal unless it's plainly wrong, and I submit that it's quite clear that it's not plainly wrong. So the very actions, the quantity and quality of the actions on the part of Ms. Pettis, I think, confirm in spades the finding of fact by the judge. So these were friends to the point that Pettis would do what she did. I think it's also important to note what this court had to say in the Gwaltney case. The holding is significant, but also what it had to say about the scope of the statute. The Gwaltney pointed out that the embezzlement statutes to begin with were enacted to deal with basically a shortcoming in law regarding the definition of larceny. And then even after they were enacted, there were still problems with the efficacy of the embezzlement laws. There were still a deficiency in a situation where there's conversion of property not entirely in the possession of another, nor lawful in the defendant's possession. They talked about gray areas. This may be a good example. And that the statute is broadly phrased because of all of that. And it's not some textbook definition or hornbook definition of larceny or embezzlement. It's a broad group of categories. I think it's very important to bear that in mind in considering the present issue. It's interesting because it talks about conversion of the property of another. Another, in this context, is a broad word. It doesn't say conversion of the property of the owner who has entrusted it to the defendant. That's a much more narrow phraseology than what we have in the statute. And Gwaltney, the holding there, to some degree, reflected all of the principles I've just said. There you had a bank teller who apparently took some money out of the till of another bank teller. So the argument is, well, they didn't entrust the money to me in that till. So whatever it is not embezzlement. And the court said, well, you have to look at the entrustment was by its very nature broader than just the one bank drawer. So for purposes of embezzlement conviction, the second bank teller's till had been entrusted to her, and so she was properly guilty. So I think in terms of the only reviewable arguments in this court, one, and if you look at the motion to strike, the motion to strike, there are three arguments to it which have nothing to do with the issues on appeal. The other one is relevant, and the argument is that there was no fiduciary relationship and no entrustment. Again, as I think Judge Beals pointed out, Chang says you don't have to have a formal fiduciary relationship. A confidential relationship is sufficient, and for the reasons that the trial judge articulated and that I've reiterated both in brief and today, I think that there was a confidential relationship. And by any measure, whether it be a strict legalistic one or just a more common sense one, there was an entrustment of the car, and the Pettis was in an increasingly bad position, and the defendant persisted in not returning it. The conversion, by the way, becomes even more clear because at one point during this 9-day episode, when Pettis was once again imploring the defendant to return the car, she offered to buy it in lieu of returning it, which is at 28. I mean, that's pretty strong evidence that she didn't intend to return that car, even though she supposedly was going to borrow it for 20 minutes to go to CVS, which, needless to say, did not happen. So, for all these reasons, given the broad scope of the statute, given the factual finding of the relationship of these two, and the various other arguments I've advanced today and on brief, I would submit that the evidence was sufficient to support the embezzlement conviction. I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you. Unless anyone has any questions.
Further questions? Ms. Freed, you have your rebuttal time.
With regard to the confidential relationship and the position of weakness, I think that Hancock versus Anderson and the Gelber versus Glock case talk about the position of weakness as a result of the relationship. And I think we talked about was the migraine, was that the position of weakness that Ms. Pettis was in? But these two individuals, there isn't one that's in a position of weakness over the other. And when we talk about this dependence or trust or weakness, we tend to think about employer-employee or power of attorney.
I need to interrupt you there, I'm afraid, but because you don't think that even after days have gone by, she doesn't know where this woman is, she's now starting to imply she's not going to return it, and she's blaming her, if I recall, for getting her and potentially in trouble with the police. And Enterprise is breathing down Ms. Pettis' neck. You don't think that now, by that point at least, Ms. Pettis is in a position of weakness versus Ms. Pittman?
She is in a position of weakness, but not because of the fiduciary relationship between the two, but because of the actions of Ms. Pittman.
I don't understand why both you and Mr. Anderson are focusing on weakness when it seems to me Glock provides other options as well. So, for example, one is trust that's justifiably reposed. The word or appears prior to that, so it seems to me that means you can have weakness, dependence, or trust. And then the words justifiably reposed, I think, arguably modify at least the word trust, if not the entire sentence. But in context, it only makes sense, I think, to apply it to the word trust. So if I trust someone with my property, as long as that trust is justifiable, in other words, not unreasonable, perhaps, then it seems to me that's enough to satisfy the Glock standard, isn't it?
With regard to trust, though, Ms. Pettis is trusting Ms. Pittman with property that she doesn't have the authority to trust her with. So she's violating the contract between her and Enterprise to give this vehicle to say, well, I'm going to violate this contract. There's no reason why I think that that kind of violates the trust between the two of them, because we already know that one party...
So you're saying, because if I understand you correctly, you're essentially arguing that because she violated the contract she had with Enterprise, any trust was not justifiable?
I know that doesn't make much sense, but
I guess... I'm just trying to understand what you're arguing.
I mean, correctly. I guess what I'm trying to argue is that Ms. Pettis is trusting Ms. Pittman to lend her this vehicle to go to the CVS when there's kind of bad dealings for the reason why Ms. Pettis even is allowed.
I think a couple of hypotheticals that might help, maybe you can explain this, is if I throw my car keys at a complete stranger and say, here, you want to borrow my car?
Right.
That's probably not justifiable.
Right.
But if it's someone I've known for a long time and have a good relationship with, I think a fact finder could reasonably conclude it would be justifiable for me to trust that person with my property.
Sure, but I think that the facts don't indicate that they had a good relationship and that they had been friends for a long time. I mean, that part of the relationship really was not explored by either counsel. I think that upon cross-examination, Ms. Pettis doesn't deny that they were estranged, and I don't think that the court found that the estrangement, while Mr. Anderson seems to think that the estrangement was only about the quality of the contact, not so much about the nature of the relationship, then there is no evidence about the nature of their relationship. Basically, we just have one person going to the hospital and saying, hey, I'm going to come pick you up, but there isn't any indication about that. Also, with regard to the Hancock versus Anderson, it has to be that one party is bound to act for the benefit of the other. There's no indication that Ms. Pettis or Ms. Pittman had to act for the benefit of one another.
Thank you, Ms. Breed.
Thank
we will greet counsel. And then the last case on our docket this morning is Arquetta Morris versus Commonwealth.